Welcome, welcome, curious souls, to the Macabre Emporium, your sanctuary for the unusual, the mysterious, and the appalling.
Step through our cryptic doorway into a world where secrets whisper and enigmas come to life.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah.
Together, we're your custodians of the macabre, guiding you through tales that defy the ordinary.
Discover the untold stories, from lesser-known cases of true crime to the bizarre events that captivate us.
Join us on a journey to the shadows where the mainstream fades and the extraordinary beckons.
So whether you seek the bizarre, the eerie, or the chillingly obscure,
you're in for a treat here at Macabre Emporium.
Welcome back to Macabre Emporium. This is episode 57.
And if you've been in search for two hosts that sound like Kermit the Frog, welcome. I'm a little still salty about that comment, but whatever. I'm sure it was all in good fun, but anyway.
Kermit the Frog here.
Kermit the Frog here. Welcome to Macabre Emporium. Yay!
God.
Wrong button anyhow. I'll cut that part out. Anyhow. So, what do you have for us this week, Sarah? Let me guess. True crime.
Uh-huh.
Shocker, I know.
What do you got? History?
Yes.
Oh, shocker.
And with International Women's Day last week, I decided to do a military badass that was suggested to us by Ben.
Ben?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He suggested it for you, but it's not your thing.
Probably not, but you'll do it justice.
Yep.
But thanks for the submission. Or the, not the submission, but the...
Suggestion.
Suggestion. That's the word.
But if you guys see anything true crime related, history, weird history, whatever, and you guys want to hear us cover it, let us know. Send us some email. Put it in the Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
Carrier pigeon, whatever.
Carrier pigeon. Shit, we're going back to those days, huh?
Yep.
Okay.
So, you ready to get started?
I am, but do you want to do your...
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. I've been doing that now.
your history.
So on this day for March 20th, growing up, the one neighbor we all had was born in 1920 in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and his name was Mr. Fred Rogers.
Oh, Mr. Rogers.
One of the best B-horror movies Sarah and I have watched, Zombievers, premieres at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2014. Yep, that came up because I kept doing songs I wanted to do a movie, and that showed up, so I stuck it in here just for you.
That movie was terrible and awesome at the same time.
Sanders Court and Cafe was founded in North Corbin, Kentucky in 1930 by Harlan Sanders to become KFC later on, or Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Hmm.
Apple announced its second model of iPod in 2002, which had 10 gigabytes of space, retailing at $499, equaling out to $869 today in today's money in 2024.
God.
And Kenny Rogers knew it was time to fold them and walk away at the age of 81 in 2020 after multiple health problems, including bladder cancer. So now that we have On This Day finished for this week, you ready to get started then, Sarah?
Mm-hmm. Are you ready to listen?
Yep.
Okay. Charles Scudder was first a student of and then the associate director of the Loyola University of Chicago Institute for Mind, Drugs, and Behavior. You ever heard of that?
Nope.
I never have either. He was also an associate professor of pharmacology while there. He was often described by friends, family, and those that he just associated with as being polished, brilliant, and a soft-spoken man, all the while remaining confident in himself. He was also quite eccentric, like having a pet monkey and continually dyeing their hair crazy colors.
All right.
I want a pet monkey. Charles was a musician as well, playing the harp. He was actually invited to play with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at one point in his life, so that's just how good he was.
All right.
I didn't know that harps were in, like, symphony orchestras.
Oh, yeah, they all have them. Pretty sure. They probably, well, don't have a very designated person. They probably have somebody that... Well, they probably do have a designated person they bring in, but mm-hmm. they also probably have like an alternative spot in the orchestra when the harp is not needed, would be my guess.
Mm, maybe.
And it also probably depends on the orchestra itself, too.
True. In the 1950s, he would marry a poet's daughter named Borti. They fell in love and got married, but they would only be married long enough to have four children together, all boys, Saul, Fenris, Gideon, and Ahab. After the birth of their fourth boy, they filed for divorce. It wasn't until all of the boys were grown adults that Charles went on to find a new lover. His longtime friend and housekeeper, Joseph Odom, became that person.
So did Ahab go to be on a ship captain later on?
I don't know. Captain Ahab?
There you go. She
Jesus
got it.
Criminy. No. While Charles was still living in Chicago and enjoying it, he eventually grew tired of the city life. He packed up some of his belongings within the Chicago mansion that he lived in search of a simpler and much calmer life. What?
Nothing.
Oh, okay, you had a smirk on your face. I'm like, what did I fuck up?
No, I'm still thinking the realization of the Captain Ahab thing.
Oh.
Sorry.
That's okay. Charles took a trip and spotted some land that he fell in love with. So he and Joe decided to move to the woods in northern Georgia to start their lives all over as a new openly gay couple. He chose an extremely isolated spot that sat on 40 acres where he didn't have to watch his beloved neighborhood turn into an urban ghetto. While he did pack most of his things before he left Chicago, he wanted out of there so badly that he left a lot of his personal belongings behind. Charles stated, within 2 short years, we were living in an elegant mini castle. Together, Charles and Joe and their 2 English mastiffs, Beelzebub, named after a demon, and Arsenath, which was named after an H.P. Lovecraft character, lived in a small camper the entire time they built their home. And when I say built their home, I mean actually built their home by hand, like just hands and hand tools built this home.
Yeah.
They started off with no running water, no phone, no electricity whatsoever, and they dug a well to have access to water eventually and used candles for light. They laid approximately 45,000 bricks by hand during the whole construction period. Upon completion of the home, it had a wood-burning stove, a chemical toilet that worked as an outhouse, and they planted and harvested their own food. For those that don't know what a chemical toilet is, basically think like a porta potty that you would use at a concert where it has all the chemicals in there so you don't smell what is in there.
It makes your poop turn blue.
That's yes, it does. That's essentially a chemical toilet. They also made a small vineyard behind the main house so that they could make their own wine.
So did they lay all 45,000 bricks on their own? Or did they
sure did.
Wow. That's a whole lot of brick.
Yeah. After the first year of building, they completed the first floor of their new castle and were able to move in. The first floor was the kitchen, dining room, and living room. And then the next year consisted of them working on the second floor, which included adding the roof to the top of the house. And upstairs held 2 bedrooms, a circular staircase that led them from main floor to second floor. Aside from the house and the vineyard, the couple also built other things on the property, such as a 3-story chicken coop. The first floor held all of the chickens and their stored food. The second floor was a stockroom full of canned goods and the couple's elaborate porn collection. And the third floor was known as the pink room. In essence, it was their pleasure chamber, where they pleasured themselves, each other, and their guests.
All right, then.
Yeah. The pink room contained mattresses, more porn, BDSM equipment, and a guest book for those to sign in with, you know, their names, but also their sexual preferences and photos. Like, even though they had all this in the third floor, like, when you see the picture of the chicken coop, it's not very big.
Yeah.
I imagine each room of it, each story, is about as big as this room, just by the looks from the outside, maybe even a little smaller. So when I said there's, like, mattresses on the floor, I'm thinking it's, like, a couple of twin mattresses, maybe.
Right. Let me guess, this whole entire floor?
It's the whole floor. Yeah. They had a sign they put up out front that said, "Beware of the Thing," near a large pink gargoyle that is at the top of the entrance, right in the front of their house.
And what they really mean, it's like a 12-foot dildo out front when you get closer to the castle.
Maybe. No, it's actually a giant pink gargoyle. They went on to name their new home and property Corpsewood Manor. They said they named it that due to all of the beauty in the bare trees around them in the fall. But it's kind of ominous, right?
Right.
Corpsewood Manor.
Right.
Especially if I'm the one bringing the fucking story. Like, what could go wrong?
Oh, we're going to name it Corpsewood Manor. Nothing wrong's going to happen here.
Right. At any rate, living in the woods and off-grid, you can expect some hunters to wander by eventually, not knowing you or your property even existed until they stumbled on it. 40 acres set way out in the woods in Georgia.
Right.
Like, oh, and it's nobody too... knows you fucking exist until they walk up on that shit.
Right, and it's then it's two gay men in Georgia in what time period again?
This would be 50s.
Oh, shit.
60s.
Okay.
Yeah. They eventually got used to it and would often have hunters just come right up to the front door and ask them if they could shoot on their property. And this is exactly how they met a man named Kenneth Avery Brock, who goes just by Avery, so that's what I'll call him from here on out. I wouldn't say they really became friends, but they were all just friendly towards each other, but not actual friends. Avery was a bit taken aback by their lifestyle and became quite suspicious of Charles and Joe. He suspected that they were multimillionaires, and while Charles was very wealthy and came from a wealthy family, he had actually put majority of his life savings into this property and the house that they now live in. And then Avery went on to tell his friend, 30-year-old Samuel Tony West, who goes by Tony, so that's what I'll call him, that the couple were queer devil worshippers that were sitting on a bounty of money. Oh, maybe this was the 80s.
Either way, two gay men living in the woods in the 50s or the 80s at this time?
Yeah. On December 12th, 1982, Avery and Tony made a plan of action to collect said assumed money. They were going to rob Charles and Joe. While en route to Corpsewood Manor, Avery and Tony stopped to pick up Tony's nephew Joey and Joey's friend Teresa. And then the four of them headed towards their bounty. Upon arrival, they were greeted by Charles, and then they all climbed the 40-foot ladder to the third floor of the chicken coop, aka the pink room. The five of them got settled in, drank some homemade wine. They also partook in some shit called Toodaloo. Toodaloo, motherfucker! I mean, because that's right. It's a mixture of paint thinner, varnish, and other chemicals inside of a plastic bag.
Oh, so they're huffing.
And they huffed it. Charles was the only one that didn't partake in the Toodaloo. And they continued to party for quite a long time before Avery went down to his car and returned with a .22 caliber Remington Speedmaster, which is a rifle. His first stop was to the house itself, where he put four bullets into Joe, followed by the two mastiffs that were sleeping next to the stove in the kitchen. Why you gotta fuck with the animals, man?
So they don't alert anybody else?
They live on 40 acres. They're not gonna alert anybody else.
Anybody else that may possibly be in there? They don't know how many people's in there.
Then they went back to Charles, tied him up before demanding money from him. Tony's nephew and his friend that had accompanied Avery and Tony, they tried to leave. They had no idea what getting in that car and driving to this place was for. They had no idea what Avery had planned to do. So they're like, what the fuck, Chuck? You know? But yeah, they didn't know what they signed up for. They tried to leave, like, immediately. Unfortunately for them, their car didn't start, so they had no choice but to return to the house. Avery and Tony continued on and ransacked the house looking for money. Avery was absolutely sure they would find, but they found no money and nothing of any real value. Tony became angry, walked up to Charles, and shot him in the head, point blank. Not once, but five times, and then they all fled. Avery and Tony had tried to steal the harp that Charles had been so good at playing at, but it didn't fit in the vehicle that they were stealing, which of course was Charlie's. Charles's, you know, because it's a harp.
Right, yeah.
And they're not harps the tiniest are thing. Fucking huge.
It's not the tiniest thing that you can just throw over your shoulder and
right.
stick in your trunk and be on your right. way.
So instead, once they figured out their own vehicle wasn't working, they chose to steal Charles's Jeep and take off to the west and head towards Mexico. They needed a break from driving, and they needed to switch vehicles, so when they hit an I-20 rest stop just outside of Vicksburg, Mississippi, they found a new car that suited them, and it belonged to a Navy lieutenant named Kirby Phelps, who they wound up murdering before they stole his vehicle.
I'm not gonna lie, I was low-key hoping you were gonna say Lieutenant Dan, just because it started in Georgia.
And because we had a Captain Ahab, so why the fuck not? On December 16th, one of the closest, distance-wise, neighbors to Charles and Joe stopped by Corbsland Manor and found bullet holes all over the door and immediately called the sheriff's office. That very same day, Tony's nephew and his friend went to the police and told them everything that had transpired on the 12th at Corbsland Manor. She even told him that she was being held captive by Tony's cousin at his mom's house because Tony was afraid she was going to run off and tell the police, which she absolutely did, and good on her for doing that. This sparked an instant nationwide search. Teresa and Joey, the nephew and his friend, helped the police and gave them their full cooperation along with everything that happened that night, so they were never charged with anything because honestly, they had no idea in the first place what the fuck Avery and Tony were going to do. Avery wound up turning himself in on December 20th, 1982, after returning to Georgia. Tony followed suit and did the same thing, but in Chattanooga, Tennessee, on Christmas Eve. Both of them would go on to receive sentences for life in prison. During the investigation into the murders, the law enforcement that went into the home were a bit shocked at what they found. They had found numerous human skulls, a plethora of satanic symbols and artifacts, and what they called gay-centric writings and art. They had a small library that had nothing in it but occult books and items. They also had a small desk with a drawer that contained about 12,000 doses of LSD. While the couple themselves didn't use drugs, they would share it at the parties in the pink room. And from what I read, all of that LSD he stole from the college or the university that he was working at.
I don't know why I found that funny, but okay.
They also found a painting that Charles had done himself with a gag in his mouth and blood dripping from 5 bullet wounds. The eerie part is he had only painted this about 5 months prior to him dying. And an acquaintance of the couple stated that Charles told her that that's how he was going to die. And he did. He died by 5 bullet holes in his fucking head.
Ooh, spooky. I know. End it. That needs to be on here.
Ugh, spooky.
Because I can do that. And trust some sound effects. But anyway.
The sheriffs involved labeled Charles and Joe as devil worshippers. It didn't help the case that the county sheriff had tried to bring charges against them before for their oddness. It just, back then, Satanism wasn't, not as wide, I can't even say wide stream because it's still not wide stream.
Right, it's probably not happened, the satanic panic probably hasn't happened yet.
Right, but they weren't able to do so because of freedom of religion.
Right.
So, go figure. One of the couple's neighbors, Raymond Williams, had once told reporters that Charles was a member of the Church of Satan, but that he wasn't an active participant. He said that Charles had told him he was an atheist, but joined the church to see what it was about. Not unlike Raymond, most of the area had no idea what the Church of Satan was or what it was about, and that they didn't condone worshiping anything other than Jesus.
Right, because all I hear is Church of Satan and not understanding what right. it truly means. It's like, oh my God, Satan, get out of here, devil. Showing up 2 weeks in a row.
Get on, get
out of here. And now that accent actually fits better this week than last week.
However, Magus Peter H. Gilmore and Magistra Blanche Barton confirmed that Charles was in fact a card-carrying member of the church. The Church of Satan's founder, Anton LaVey, also came forward and stated that he had been in contact with Charles on multiple occasions. It's rumored that he had actually visited Corpsewood Manor at some point, but there's never been any proof of his visits there. No pictures, no nothing. A few weeks before he was murdered, Charles actually got a card delivered from the Church of Satan wishing him a happy 56th birthday.
I was about to fucking say that.
Yeah.
And it's a picture of Satan holding the birthday cake.
Toodaloo! Sorry. That's all I could think about.
So we can't call it huffing like an adult. We gotta call it Toodaloo.
That's what they named it. It was Toodaloo. That was whatever that concoction of paint thinner, varnish, and other chemicals was called. It was Toodaloo. But yes, they huffed the Toodaloo. Friends of the couple have said that with them being openly gay back then, in a time where that was not something you talked about, and if you were gay, you didn't let anybody know, that the Church of Satan's anything goes between consenting adults policy would have looked extremely nice to them. Back then, there was a ton of discrimination against those that weren't straight. During Avery and Tony's trials, they accused Charles of spiking the wine he offered them with LSD in order to get them to perform oral sex on him. However, when the bottle of wine was tested, there was not even a trace amount of LSD in it. Tony tried to claim involuntary intoxication, but come the fuck on, you can't force somebody to drink. You cannot force somebody to fucking drink. You drank because you wanted to. That's it. Tony had already confessed to an officer that he and Avery had pre-planned the robbery, but not the murders. He also told the officer that Avery did indeed want to kill Charles because he had heard, as in rumor, had heard that he had oral sex with a 17-year-old kid. Dr. Karsmar was a former colleague of Charles, and he was put on the stand as a character witness. He stated that Charles was not into drugs, he didn't abuse them. He also said that Charles was not a Satanist. Instead, he told the court quite the opposite. And kind of harped on, no pun intended, kind of harped on how Charles was always dependable and just bright.
Yeah.
The funeral for Charles and Joe was very small. It was on their property. Joe's ashes got scattered in the rose garden closest to the house, while Charles's ashes were taken by his sister and they went back to Wisconsin with her to be buried in their family plot on April 25th, 1983. Charles's harp and his statue of Mephistopheles are now the property of Bobby Lee Cook, who is a defense attorney. Bobby was hired by Charles's four sons to represent them as the heir to Charles's estate. Joe's sister also claimed the estate since she knows that Charles would have left everything to him, to Joe. So she wants her family's fair share, I guess.
Yeah.
Avery is still currently serving his sentence in the Coffee Corrections Facility in Nichols, Georgia. And Tony is currently at the Wilcox State Prison in Abbeville, Georgia. Both men have been denied parole numerous times, but they're both still alive.
Fortunately. They'll probably die from cancer from the old do and the toodaloo win.
Toodaloo, motherfuckers.
Yeah, pretty much.
Corpsewood Manor was purchased not long after the murders took place. And from the jump, stories began to make their way around about the strange happenings in and around the home, the weird things they owned. People still claim to this day that the property is haunted. There have been a lot of reports of people hearing gunshots, barking dogs, and hearing a harp being played.
It's fucking backwoods of Georgia. Of course you're going to hear dogs and gunshots.
You're going to hear a harp?
Well, you're not. Okay, the harp part cannot be explained, but gunshots and dogs barking in Georgia, come on.
Right. But still, all very possible things that you would have heard when the couple was still alive.
Right.
But that's that. Corpsewood Manor.
So is Corpsewood Manor still standing, or you couldn't find that?
It is.
Cool.
Yeah. It is. There's a group on Facebook that I think that one of them is like partial owner of it, mm-hmm. and they're actually restoring the property to what it was. And Charles had made two stained glass windows, and they were both really cool. One of them was a Baphomet, and the other one was a skull. But they're really well done. They're really,
I can only imagine,
stained glass. Come on.
If they built this entire castle
by hand, yeah,
by hand, I'm sure they had the ability to make stained glass window.
Oh yeah, it's really pretty though. But yeah, that for sure is the end of my portion. Okay. What'd you think of that story?
That was pretty good.
Have you ever heard of that before?
I don't think I have.
Okay, good. I was hoping you hadn't. But what'd you got?
I have a World War I badass. Yay. And it's a lady badass.
Okay, you gotta make it interesting to me.
Well, I'm sure this intro that I wrote has made it, you know, is gonna suck you in, basically. But okay. I mean, it's a lady badass from World War I, so that doesn't have your interest already. Okay.
But any story that I've been, like, not real excited to hear has always come out fucking great. And I'm like, that was so good.
Right.
So.
All right. So.
You're going to do it again. I know.
Like I always do.
Uh-huh.
All right. Belgrade, 1964. 50 years after the start of World War I, ceremonies and events are being held across the country of Serbia. But at the Monument of Gratitude to France, military officers and dignitaries from around the world are gathering. These officers and others from France, Britain, and the United States chat among themselves with their stories of war. A little old lady shuffles to the front row in a long coat with a cane in her hand for support. These men watch as she takes a seat in the front row as their conversations turn from about themselves to who this old woman is. Hearing their chatter, she smiles to herself as they try to figure out who she is. Finally, one of these officers asks, "Ma'am, who are you?" The old woman stands before them and opens her coat, revealing a chest full of medals that gleam in the sunlight. I'm sorry, ma'am. I didn't mean any disrespect. Could you please tell us your story?" Her age soon fades away. "My name is Malika Savage, and let me tell you a story about how I fought for my country when women like me weren't allowed to."
Okay, you got me roped in. Okay.
Malika Savage's birth date is widely unknown due to no records of her family, but is believed to be born on June 28, 1888, in the village of Krupnevica, Serbia. Not else is known about her childhood except that she did have her brother named Milan. This fact is known about her brother because her brother was called to service during the First Balkan War. In 1912, the nations that make up the Balkans, Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, and Montenegro, joined forces to push the Ottoman Empire out of Europe. Serbia alone would call up 225,000 men, which was 9% of the country's entire population. The countries that make up the Balkans would gather up a total of 750,000 fighting men and one woman. The military search for fighting men even included the tiny village where the Savage's family lived, which only had a population of 20. Her brother was suffering from tuberculosis at the time, so she would take his place at the age of 24.
And they allowed that?
They didn't know that. Because she cut her hair short and put on his uniform.
Okay.
She did quickly see combat in both of the Balkan Wars and was assigned to the Iron Regiment unit, where she was promoted to corporal. Her brother was. But by her 10th deployment, she would be wounded by a grenade at the Battle of Brnesenia during the Second Balkan Conflict, and this is where the field surgeons would discover that Corporal Savage was a woman. She did recover, but high-ranking officers were unsure what to do with her, as she was a remarkable soldier, as she has proven many times over. The brass offered her a transfer over to the nursing unit, but she refused this offer. And this is where women were only allowed to serve at this time, was in the medical field of things. Which, she stood at attention, and she insisted she wanted to fight for her country as a combatant and not a nurse, so she refused this offer. Her commanding officer, contemplating her words, and told her he would give her his decision on what to do with her the next day. As she replied, "I will wait." He would only let an hour go by as she remained at attention, awaiting his words, allowing her to still fight. In 1914, in the early days of World War I, she was awarded her first Kettigorge Star with swords, which is Serbia's highest honor after the Battle of Kolubara. Here she would take the fight to the enemy, charging across no man's land with her rifle and two bandoliers of grenades. She would single-handedly clear out an Austrian trench with her grenades, and then run to the next one where she took 20 soldiers as prisoners of war. After sending them back, she would then assault a third trench with her grenades again, and wouldn't stop her Jane Wick type of fight until she was hit by shrapnel from an artillery shell.
Did you call her Jane Wick?
Yes, I did. Because G.I. Jane's overplayed, and yes, making it more relevant to our age group.
Jane Wick, I like it.
She would receive her second star after the Battle of Srebrenica in 1916, where she captured 23 Bulgarian soldiers, this time by herself, in the same style of assault she just did in the previous conflict.
By herself.
She had no fucks to give and went running across no man's land.
I guess not. Shit.
Like, she said she wanted to fight for a country, she fucking meant she did.
Clearly. But at that point, was she still using her brother's name?
No, they were clear. They knew who she was at this point.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the Serbian soldiers weren't able to hold out against their opposing force, and the Serbians had to retreat across the mountains and along the coastline of Albania with only 100,000 troops left.
Oof.
They were evacuated by the British and French, and her unit would become a Serbian brigade in the French army. She would go on to fight in the Tunisian front and again on the Macedonian front until 1918, where she became a non-commissioned officer. Do you know what that is?
Mm-mm.
So what a non-commissioned officer is that she's of a lower rank of a commanding officer, but she holds a leadership position. So in case something happens to them, she's now in charge.
She's a boss lady.
Yeah, pretty much. Nice. She's a boss bitch, basically, at this point. She would be wounded a total of 9 times and be decorated time and time again by other countries for her bravery. She would be awarded the Russian Order of Holy George for courage, the British Medal of St. Michael, the French Legion of Honor twice, and the only woman in World War II to win the France Croix de Guerre, which is their version of the Medal of Honor. I forgot to put that in my notes. Pretty sure that's okay. Correct. Or it's their version. No, it's their version of the Bronze Star for bravery in the United States military.
Okay.
And again, if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me. So how good of a soldier was she? One of the stories about Malinka is that a French officer couldn't believe a woman was capable of fighting like a man. So in Thessaloniki, Greece, this officer challenged Malinka to prove her skills. He challenged her to shoot a bottle of 1800 cognac and said if she could shoot it at 40 meters or 130 feet, the other 19 bottles in the case were hers. So it only took her one single shot to destroy this bottle.
No shit.
He refused to believe that she could do this. So he's like, I also heard you're pretty good with grenades.
What? Wait, like that first shot was a fluke?
Yeah.
Just dumb luck?
Pretty much.
She couldn't be that good?
Yeah.
Fuck that
guy. Yeah, I think this is early 1900s.
Yeah, I know.
So he also heard about her skills with grenades and everything. So she took another bottle from the case and took it out with a grenade in the first throw. Now, sources did not specify if she took it out by just throwing it live or not. I'm going to guess this grenade wasn't live.
Mm-hmm. No, I'd hope not.
Because all the sources that did come up with it, they just said that she took it out with a grenade. Even after the war, she continued to receive awards from different countries, including her home country of Serbia, earning 12 medals in total.
Damn.
She did decline a military pension from France that she was offered for service, but wanted to stay in Serbia. Here she would go on to marry Felicio Gilovorvic, and they would have a daughter of their own. And they would adopt 3 more children after this. They would eventually get divorced, and then she would go on to help 32 other children finish school. It is more than likely she knew how important this was because she was possibly illiterate herself.
Aww.
During World War II, she was placed in a concentration camp after being beaten by police for almost a year after she was found giving aid to freedom fighters. The camp's commander recognized who she was and ordered her to be released with all military honors. Who knows, it could be a case of honor among soldiers or the stories of Malinka preceding her time in the camp, knowing it would be the end of them all if she got her hands on a grenade and some grenades and a rifle.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to believe was the case, but it's probably more like honor among soldiers, basically.
Nah.
It could be the former. Right? It's like, do you guys know who she is? That's the Lady of the Dark. She'll take us all out.
Uh-huh.
Her story mostly went unknown until the 1960s when she attended a celebration for those who fought in World War II, which is the same celebration that I started this off with, where many military officers spoke to her about her actions. During the 1970s, even more people came to know the Lady of the Dark as she was highlighted in a newspaper article about her difficult financial and living situation and was given a small apartment by the city of Belgrade. Malinka would die in 1973 and was buried in the family mausoleum until 2013. It was brought to the Alley of the Greats in Belgrade, New Cemetery. Here is where all Serbian distinguished citizens and war heroes are buried.
Aww.
In 2013, a documentary was made about her time in the military, and one of my now favorite bands, Sabaton, has written a song about her named Lady of the Dark.
No. No way.
I did try to find if that was just a song title. Or if that was a name she was given, I couldn't find an answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
That is Malinka Savage, a World War I lady badass.
Lady badass, boss bat, boss bass.
Mm-hmm. Boss bitch.
Yes. Lady badass, boss bitch. That I decided to do. That's her official title.
Mm-hmm. That I decided to do since International Women's Day was last week.
Yeah. Speaking of, how many of you got your ring pops ready for that? And how many men had them in their prison wallet? Wow. Thank you, Deadpool.
Yeah, see, there's either people that are going to get that right off the bat or going to be like, what the hell is she talking about?
Dude, that was the best part of the whole fucking movie.
Like, where was that ring pop at?
Well.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's Malinka Savage.
I liked it. See? Again, something I like, you know, I'm not into war-y type stuff. But you write it in such a way.
Yep.
I don't like it.
I open the, you write these openers.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, fuck, who is this? And
then you
yep.
suck me. And that's our show for today. No, good job.
Thanks.
I liked that.
Nothing else. Can remember, Wednesday night Twitch, either Jackbox Party Pack or co-op game of some sort that Sarah, Lindsay, and boop, boop. Her friend Bird's playing, or boop, boop.
Ashley.
I don't know why I can't remember her name.
Ashery.
Yeah. Started doing some Jackbox games, probably maybe do that every other week and go with that. And then Thursday night, it's going to be me playing just me solo or maybe just continuation of Noodle and I and Ashley. Who knows?
Or it could just be you playing by yourself.
No.
I was going to try to make that sound dirty, but it didn't come out dirty.
Oh, so it didn't work out for you?
Oh.
Yeah, you forgot I had those now.
Yep, I did. I sure did.
So, those Twitch streams, they always start at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. There you go. Figure that out from your time zone. And who knows, there may be a random stream from here now, too, and that's not on one of those days.
Yeah.
This past Monday, had a crappy day at work. I decided to jump on and talk to you guys while we played some Supermarket Simulator.
Supermarket Simulator. Mm-hmm. He was the cheese master.
No, we can only sell shredded bag cheese right now, which apparently is too expensive for everybody.
What are you trying to sell it for, like $10 a bag?
Like a quarter over market price. Yeah, I know.
That profit margin, though. Anyways.
Yeah. Anyways, I think it's time we close the Emporium up for the day. What do you think, Sarah?
I agree.
So until next time.
Remember to Kermit Real.
Okay, bye.
Please go and check out our website at macabreemporiumpodcast.com. Join our Facebook group by searching Macabre Emporium. Like and subscribe on YouTube at Macabre Emporium Podcast. Follow us on TikTok at Macabre Emporium Pod. Follow us on Twitter at Macabre Emporium. If you have any stories of the paranormal, your local true crime, or weird history that you would like us to look into and possibly do an episode on, email us at macabreemporiumpod@gmail.com. And remember to follow, rate, review, and share whenever and wherever you can to help us grow our podcast. He also told the officer that Avery did indeed want to kill Charles because he had heard that he had had oral sex with a 17-year-old kid. What? Uh-uh.
Her food's out.